Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you might be joining us from today. I want to welcome you to the Accessibility Online webinar series. This program is a collaborative effort between the U.S. Access Board and the ADA National Network. The session is going to be addressing marinas and boating facilities today, and we're glad that you were able to join us. Just a couple of housekeeping things as we get started today. We were conducting some sound checks earlier and letting people know that the captioning and such was working, but just to review all of those different issues at this time. If you are interested in accessing the closed captioning to follow along, there is a click on the CC icon at the top of your screen or using Control F8 on your keyboard. Once you have the dialog box, you are then able to adjust that screen and move it anywhere you want on the box or on your view for yourself. Questions can be asked by typing and submitting the questions in the chat area text box, or if you're using a keyboard, just Control M will let you enter the text into the chat area. The chat, what you enter will be able to be seen by the presenters, but we are asking you to hold your questions and enter those in when we're ready to take them. It can sometimes get overwhelming with so many questions pouring in all the time for the presenters, and we want to make sure we don't miss anybody's questions. So just hold those in. When we're ready to take them, ask you to submit them at that time. Again, please do not use your the emotions or raising of hand features during the session. It can get distracting for other people to see those things happening or going on, so we just ask that you refrain from using those. And at this time, I am going to go ahead and turn it over to Peggy Greenwell, who will introduce our presenters for today. Thank you, and go ahead, Peggy.
Thanks, Robin, and welcome everyone to our session today on accessible marinas and boating facilities. Today, I'll be presenting along with Paul Beatty. And for those of you who don't know me, a little bit about my background. I've been here at the board since 1992 and have specialized in recreation facilities, accessibility guidelines with recreation facilities, and was involved in the development of the boating facility guidelines. Paul Beatty is also a veteran accessibility specialist. In fact, he's been at the board since 1988. He has been involved in nearly all of the rulemaking efforts that have gone on at the Access Board and currently is the lead of our rulemaking on passenger vessels. So for our session today, I'm going to first turn it over to Paul, and then I will join in towards the end of the presentation. We would like to have you hold your questions, which will for the end of the session, so that you'll have the opportunity to submit those in the chat room, and we should have sufficient time to be able to address them. We do appreciate those people who submitted questions in advance, and Paul and I will be answering them throughout the presentation on the different topic areas that you asked the question. So without further hesitation, I'm going to turn it over to Paul. And we're on slide four.
Hello. Yes, it is a good afternoon here in D.C. Slide four gives us our agenda. We're going to be talking about the ADA and Architecture Barriers Act standards. We'll be looking at newly constructed and existing marinas, how those standards apply. We will be talking about, to a limited degree, other ADA requirements that are outside the standards that may come into play, but the main focus will be on the boating facility provisions in the standards. We will be talking about the alteration provisions in those standards, and as Peggy pointed out, we will have questions at the end. Now, a lot of people, we have 90 minutes, and we recognize we can't answer everybody's questions, and I can't overstate the importance of our sources of technical assistance from the Access Board. There will be a slide at the very end that gives our 800 line and other ways of getting technical assistance, and I strongly encourage you to call if you need some further explanation based upon this presentation. Next slide, number five, please. Let's start with the Americans with Disability Act. As many of you know, Title II of the Americans with Disability Act applies to state and local government facilities. In the picture there, you have the St. Petersburg, Florida Municipal Marina. So we'd shorthand call that a Title II facility. Slide number six, please. Title III of the Americans with Disability Act applies to private entities that are commercial facilities and public accommodations. A private entity that's a marina most likely would be a public accommodation under the ADA. We want to point out that ADA is not strictly applying to those for-profit private entities, but can apply to nonprofits. The picture there is of the D.C. Marina, which is in Washington, D.C. Next slide, number seven. The Architecture Barriers Act is an older law. It was written in 1968. It principally applies to the federal government. Says federal government, when you design something, if you construct it or alter it, and if you lease it, you have to meet certain access requirements set forth in the standards. This law can also apply if somebody builds something on behalf of the federal government. So if you have a visitor center, for example, that might be constructed with non-federal dollars on federal property, the odds are it triggered the Architecture Barriers Act. The Architecture Barriers Act can apply to non-federal entities where a federal grant or loan is provided for construction and alteration purposes. The picture here is a marina on Lake Powell, and I understand Lake Powell is controlled by the Army Corps of Engineers. Slide number eight, please. We'll be talking about the new standards under the ADA and slightly older standards on the Architecture Barriers Act. These primarily deal with design and construction requirements and alteration provisions. Because our focus is on design and construction, for the most part, we will not be addressing issues that aren't related to design and construction. A good example was a question, actually, we're going to sort of answer it. Are there any ramp guidelines to discuss accessible maximum slope for people in wheelchairs where assistance is available to them? And the particular question noted United Nations recommendation of 10% maximum acceptable slope. We don't know of any federal provisions that set out a maximum slope where assistance is provided. We will be pretty much pointing out the minimum requirements in these standards, recognizing they do not address every access issue out there. Slide number nine, please. Starting first with the 2010 ADA standards from the Department of Justice, these were finalized in September 15, 2010. They weren't created in isolation. You have there in the slide sort of a path that the Access Board took to assist the Department of Justice in developing the standard. We started with the early version of the ADA guidelines that was written back in 1991 and the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standard through an advisory committee as well as a proposed rules where public comment was received. We developed the 2004 ADA and Architecture Barriers Act Accessibility Guidelines. Slide number 10, please. Some of you are very familiar with the 2004 ADA and Architecture Barriers Act guidelines. It's really a three-part document. Some people are confused between guidelines and standards. The Access Board under the ADA, as well as the Architecture Barriers Act, is responsible to write guidelines, set forth minimum construction, design, and alteration provisions. These guidelines are not legally enforceable. These guidelines tell agencies the right enforceable standards, what are their minimum requirements for the standard. For example, if we said in our guidelines a 100-space parking lot needs four accessible parking spaces, when the Department of Justice, for example, develops their ADA standard based upon our guidelines, they cannot say three because that's obviously less than the minimum of four. They can say four, which is consistent with our guidelines, and if they wanted to, they could say five, six, seven. In other words, they could set forth requirements that are beyond our minimums. The Department of Justice standard is based upon our ADA guidelines, which is really, if you look at the slide, It's, you can see the little picture that says ADA application and scoping chapters, and then common technical. So essentially, Department of Justice adopted the upper left and the center common technical provisions. That is the ADA Accessibility Guidelines. We'll be talking about the Architecture Barriers Act. The guidelines for the Architecture Barriers Act is the upper right, Architecture Barriers Act application and scoping chapters, and the common technical provisions. Slide number 11. Again, on September 15, 2010, Department of Justice updated their ADA regulations for Title II, state and local governments, and Title III, private entities that are commercial facilities and public accommodations. In updating these regs, they created their 2010 standards, and as I said, they're based upon our 2004 ADA guidelines, plus they added additional requirements, things that went beyond the minimums of our guidelines. For example, it's not boating related, but in our guidelines, we required 2% of prison cells to be accessible. When the Department of Justice developed their 2010 standards, they said, in the additional requirements, they said, no, we want 3% to be accessible. Most of the additional requirements have nothing to do with boating facilities. Now, the Department of Justice regulations also talk about how the standards apply to existing facilities, and we will briefly touch on that. Slide number 12, please. Many of you who are familiar with ADA and the Access Board work have, since 2004, gotten copies of our 2004 ADA guidelines. It's about an inch thick document. Because we'll be focusing first on the ADA side, and if you're not concerned about Architecture Barriers Act, you essentially go into the document and rip out pages 72 through 140, all the section numbers that begin with the letter F for federal, and you essentially have the 2004 ADA guidelines, which Department of Justice incorporated into their ADA standard. And those will be the focus of our discussion, the boating provisions in that document. Now, I should also point out that DOT has an ADA standard. Their ADA standard is essentially the Access Board's 2004 ADA guidelines. They made some minor changes, less changes, basically in four areas. None of them relate to recreation boating. So you can comply with DOT standards as well as Department of Justice standards because it's the exact same provisions when it comes to recreation boating. Architecture Barriers Act. We will be talking a little bit more about that, but again, they adopted our Architecture Barriers Act guidelines, and the Architecture Barriers Act guidelines that apply to, or the provisions that apply to boating facilities are identical to the Department of Justice and Department of Transportation. So there's one set of requirements that apply to recreation boating in the standards. Slide number 13, please. Let's start with new construction. Let's say I'm building a new marina. What do I need to comply with? Slide number 14, please. With the Department of Justice, their standards, yes, they were published on September 15, 2010, but they're not mandatory till March 15, 2012. Between September of 2010 and March of 2012, Department of Justice says that an entity can use either the 91 standard or the 2010 standard. Well, the 91 standard had nothing in it about recreation boating. Does that mean you could build a marina today using the 91 standard with no access requirements in your boating area? I guess conceptually you could. We would say that's pretty foolish. Because come March 15, 2012, there's no question that you'll have some retrofit requirements. And we will talk about how the ADA regulations from the Department of Justice require you to go back and correct existing facilities. Now, slide number 15. Architecture Barriers Act, you're building a new facility. Let's say it's at a Department of Defense facility. It's a welfare and rec marina where service members can park their boat. That would be subject to the Architecture Barriers Act, and would have to comply with the Architecture Bears Act standard. Now, it's a little complicated under the Architecture Bears Act because there are four agencies that write standards. Most federal agencies are subject to the General Service Administration standard, and on the slide you can see there that General Service Administration has had requirements, basically our Architecture Bears Act guidelines, which contain boating provisions. They've had those since May of 2006. So since the early 2006, for those agencies subject to the Architecture Bears Act, if they built a marina, if they altered a marina that they controlled, or if they provided a federal grant or loan to somebody else to do it, the odds are there have been access requirements under the Architecture Bears Act that have applied since 2006. Now, GSA does not have jurisdiction over every federal agency. For example, the Department of Defense is a standard-setting agency under the Architecture Bears Act, and they have their Architecture Bears Act standard, which is identical to GSA's. Postal Service has their own Architecture Bears Act standard. Now, I don't think they have any recreation boating, but their standard is nearly identical to GSA's. The only agency, which is HUD, that has not adopted the new provisions is HUD, and their jurisdiction is over residential. So in most situations, HUD's regs would not come into play under the Architecture Bears Act. So in summary, using the Architecture Bears Act standard or the ADA standards from Department of Justice or DOT, you have the same recreation boating provisions. Slide number 16. This is a layout quickly of the 2004 ADA guidelines and the Architecture Bears Act Accessibility Guidelines, the three-part document. We will be focusing on Chapter 2, Scoping Requirements, and Chapter 10, Common Technical Provisions Dealing with Recreation Facilities. ADA Chapter 2 Scoping Requirements is nearly identical to Architecture Bears Act Chapter 2 Scoping Requirements. So when we say ADA scoping requires X number of slips to be accessible, it's the same requirement in the Architecture Bears Act standard. Slide number 17. Existing facilities. A lot of people say, okay, I can look at the new construction requirements, I can apply them to my new marina, but I got my existing facility. What do I have to do to it? So let's go to slide 18 and sort of set the stage. We're going to be talking about program accessibility and readily achievable bear removal. These are not requirements in the ADA standard. These are requirements that come from the Department of Justice regulations. Program accessibility comes and applies to Title II entities. Readily achievable bear removal applies to Title III entities that are public accommodation, which would be most privately owned marinas. Under program accessibility, state and local governments have to make sure that persons with disability are not denied access to programs and services they provide. So a boating facility is a program of the state and local government, and persons with disability cannot be denied access to programs and services when the program is viewed in its entirety that it's available. That means architecturally, some marinas need to be changed in order for the program, the marina program offered by the state or the local government, to be accessible to persons with disability. Program accessibility requirements have existed since 1992. Although even though the standards have not addressed boating facilities until now recently, there have been a program access obligation. Title III, readily achievable bear removal, is a little bit different than program accessibility. Private entities or public accommodations have to go in and correct non-conforming features, match up with what the standard says, but only where it was readily achievable. Now, the term is not well-defined. The closest the regs say is easily accomplishable, able to be carried out without much difficulty or expense, and is an ongoing obligation. So if somebody looked at their facility back in 1992 and said, whoa, there's no way I can correct 100% of it today, Well, if you could do 5% because that was readily achievable, you're expected to do 5%. Next year, you might have to do another 5%. In other words, the way you're chipping away at things were readily achievable. Now, the standard, the 1991 standard, had nothing dealing with boating facilities. So therefore, one might have been able to argue that there were no barriers in my boating facility, although that is probably more of a question you would have to pose to the Department of Justice. But now, with the 2010 standard, it's clear what is a barrier, at least as it relates to boating facilities, and therefore what would have to be corrected were readily achievable. Slide number 19. The question has arisen, and Department of Justice has addressed it, well, what if I built a facility and I complied totally with the 91 standard, or I had an existing facility and I complied with the 91 standard because of program access or barrier removal? Now the standard has changed. Does that mean I need to go in and start correcting things under program access, start correcting things under barrier removal to match up with the new requirements in the 2010 standard? Department of Justice has said in their regulations for program access and barrier removal, the elements that comply with the 91 standards do not need to be modified to meet the 2010 standards unless those elements are altered on or after March 15, 2010. So I have a non-conforming feature. It complies with the 91 standard but doesn't comply with the 2010 standard. I'm not required to change it. However, if I alter that after March 15, on or after March 15, then what I touch, I fix. Now, Department of Justice says that this safe harbor does not apply to elements in existing facilities that were not subject to specific requirements in the 91 standard. Slide number 20, please. The 91 standard addressed a lot of things that are also addressed in the 2010 standard, like toilet rooms. However, the 91 standard did not address things shown on this list that are in the 2010, a lot of them to do with recreation. So if you can see there in parentheses C, recreation boating facilities. So therefore, recreation boating facilities that do not comply with the 2010 standard would be subject to program access and would be subject to barrier removal were readily achievable. What is not shown in the slide and other slides that we want to point out, and Peggy will go into a little bit more about this, somebody's doing an alteration, and under the standard, when you do alterations, you trigger accessibility improvements. One of the requirements that is very complicated is the, goes by a number of names. It's primary functionary alteration, the 20% rule, the alteration that triggers path of travel. I want to quickly state the provision and then talk about how this safe harbor does or does not apply. When you do alteration scenario, classify it as a primary function area, and I'll explain momentarily what that is, you're required to spend an additional 20% of the cost of the alteration on making accessible improvements to the path of travel. Now, primary function area in general is where a major activity takes place. So if I renovate a boating facility, most likely the boating facility is a primary function area. It's where a major activity takes place. In simplistic terms, you could talk about space I specifically constructed the facility for. So I built a marina, obviously. The boat slips are a primary function area. So if I alter that area, obviously what I alter has to be conforming. If I alter the primary function area, I'm required to make additional accessible improvements on the path of travel. Now the path of travel is a number of things. It's the route that essentially got you from site arrival points to the altered primary function area. It also includes toilet rooms, drinking fountains, and public telephones that serve the primary function area. So I got this marina. It totally complies with the 91 standard, meaning my toilet rooms, my parking comply with the 91 standard. I'm altering the boat slips. So I did a primary function area alteration. I triggered the path of travel requirement. I'm required to spend an additional 20% of the cost of the alteration on making accessible improvements to the path of travel. I look at my toilet room, it complies with the 91 standard, but it doesn't comply with the 2010 standard. In the Department of Justice regulations, you're not required to change the toilet room. For those things that fall under the safe harbor, that are subject to the path of travel, if it complies with the 91 standard, you're not required to change it under path of travel. Slide number 21, please. Now, Peggy will go into a lot more detail about the provisions dealing specifically with boating facilities. There are the scoping provisions in Section 235 and the technical provisions in Section 1003. But we do want to talk about some other components of a boating facility that people overlook, that the standards address. So let's go to some other facilities, but let's go first to slide 22 and get the big picture. Here I have marina. We have our basin where we have our boat slips and our gangways. And around the perimeter, we can see we have a number of other things, from parking to toilet rooms to even a hotel and a yacht club. So there are a lot of components that aren't boating slips and directly subject to the 235 scoping requirements or technical provisions in Section 1003, but are addressed in the ADA and Architecture Barriers Act standards. And we want to talk a few about, talk a little bit about some of these. Slide number 23. Big thing, exterior accessible routes. The accessible route gets you from point A to point B. So from site arrival points like parking to specific buildings like the yacht club or the gangway that connects you to the boat slips. Slide number 24. Another picture of a boating facility that's more primitive. We have our slips down at the bottom in a body of water with a gangway connecting it. And then from the gangway, you have a winding accessible route that brings you to the parking at the top. And basically, that's all you have is parking, accessible route, and boat slips. So the exterior accessible route would be getting you from the parking all the way down to the boat slips. Now, Peggy will be talking about the gangway provisions, the accessible route that is part of the gangway, and getting you to the actual boat slip itself. Slide number 25. The 2010 standard, as well as the 91 standard, addressed parking. There's no change in the overall parking table. So a 400-space parking lot needs 8 spaces that are accessible. Now, the 91 standard, how many spaces had to be van accessible? And some of you know, in the 91 standard, it said 1 out of every 8 accessible spaces will be van accessible. So the 400-space parking lot that had 8 accessible spaces, 1 of the 8 had to be van accessible. Now in the 2010 standard, it's changed. It's 1 out of every 6. So that 400-space parking lot that has 8 accessible parking spaces now is required to have 2, because you always round up, 2 spaces that are van accessible. Now, does that mean you have to go back and change your existing parking lots that complied with the 91 standard, either under program access or bear removal were readily achievable? No, because of the safe harbor provisions I pointed out. If the parking complied with the 91 standard, you're not required to change it until you alter the parking. Slide number 26. Accessible routes obviously have components that are more than just the walking surface itself, but doors. So here we have a picture of a ramp going up into a ship's door. And yes, there's problems with the ramp in terms of handrails on both sides. But you would go up the ramp, you would have a landing, plus the door itself would have a certain amount of maneuvering clearance. For the most part, the maneuvering clearance requirements are unchanged from the 91 standard. Slide number 27. Our accessible route goes from the exterior to the interior because you're not only connecting site arrival points with buildings and accessible entrances of buildings, but you're also going into the building and connecting accessible components when here. So here we have an accessible route winding through a shopping, a clothing store. But you think of a ship store that might be at a marina, you would need an accessible route going through the store to each of the self-service shelving. Now, there's no retrain requirements to the shelves, but you would still need the accessible route to get you to each of the self-service shelving. Slide number 28. Some marinas, a lot of marinas have toilet rooms, and some have bathing facilities. And, of course, both the 91 standard and the 2000 standard address these. Now, for bathing facilities, you have the roll-in shower, and which is in the upper left on the slide, and you have the transfer shower, which is in the upper right. The roll-in shower is not required to have a seat. It's not transient lodging. That's the only place where a seat is mandated, although the board would recommend that when you put in a roll-in shower, you provide a seat. The transfer shower must have a seat. Now, does it require all showers to be accessible? No. At least one will be accessible, and you have the choice of either putting in the roll-in or the transfer where you provide showers. We're not telling you to provide showers. It's when you provide a bathing facility, then it must comply. Now, the figure at the bottom shows a single-user toilet room. For those that are familiar with the 2010 standard, they automatically see a problem. Now, this figure has been a little squished a little bit, so it's a little bit out of proportion, but we sort of show the maneuvering clearances and clearances required at fixtures and how they can overlap. But there is a change in the 2010 standard, slide number 29. In the 2010 standard, the lavatory cannot project into the clearance allowed around the water closet in a single-user toilet room, which was allowed in the 1991 standard. Slide number 30. The 2010 standard requires, you can see the clearance there around the water closet, limits what can project into the clearance. The lavatory, the sink, is one of the items that may not project into the clearance, so additional space is needed. Now again, does that mean you need to change your single-user toilet rooms that comply with the 91 standard under program access or barrier removal? No, remember the safe harbor. If it's addressed in the 91 standard and complies with the 91 standard, you're not required to change it under program access or barrier removal until you alter it. Slide number 31. Yes, we've seen this slide before, transfer stalls. It's a little bit bigger. We wanted to point out, because a lot of people now, okay, I have a shower, I'll put in this transfer stall, and they forget two things. First, if you notice the space for the wheelchair, it's 36 by 48, but it extends 12 inches beyond the seat. So, you know, you need that little bump out so somebody can make the transfer. The second thing that people often overlook, maybe how do you get to that 36 by 48 space? If you have to come down and make a 90-degree turn, then you need an increased length of 60 inches, okay? So the point here is sometimes when you look at the minimum requirements of the standard and quickly look at the figure and you say that's all that's required and you put it in per the figure, there are other provisions that you need to be aware of. A good point to point out why we have the technical assistance line and why we are ready to provide technical assistance to help you, particularly those that are new to the standard, in understanding specific provisions and as well as how other provisions come into play. Slide number 32. Now, the 2010 standard, unlike the 1991 standard, addresses recreation facilities like swimming pools, fishing piers, exercise rooms, miniature golf, play areas, and also regular golf. We are not going to be discussing those in this presentation due to the length of the time. We will be focusing on boating facilities. Slide number 33. Before I turn it over to Peggy, we're talking about recreation boating facilities. We are not talking about ferry docks. Okay, that's a rulemaking that we hopefully will be able to address when we put out the passenger vessel rule. The boating facilities, as I said before, are identical in the ADA standard, 2010 ADA standard from the Department of Justice, the Department of Transportation's ADA standard, as well as the Architecture Barriers Act standards used by all federal agencies except for HUD. So now I will turn it over to Peggy, slide number 34.
Okay, thank you, Paul. And we're now going to move into the provisions for recreational boating facilities. And what you see here is the section number that you should focus your attention on in terms of the scoping provisions for the boating facilities. Scoping provisions, if you're not familiar with them, are those provisions that tell you how many things are required to be accessible, where different elements are to be located, and other scoping issues. So Section 235 of the 2010 standard, and that would also be F235 if you're dealing with federal facilities, deal with the number of boat slips required to be accessible, and that's always based on the number of slips that you provide. It also includes dispersion requirement for accessible boat slips to be dispersed throughout the various types provided, and also the number of boarding piers at boat launch ramps that are required to be accessible. Slide 35. So in Chapter 10, Section 1003 is where all the technical provisions for boating facilities are included. And in that technical chapter, we have provisions related to fixed and floating facilities, accessible routes, gangways, boat slips, accessible boat slips, and boarding piers at boat launch ramps. So those are the elements that we have technical provisions for in Section 1003. Slide 36. So when you're thinking about applying these provisions, you should be considering a facility, if you're considering a facility such as the one that's illustrated here on slide 36, you see this is a marina facility that has five different docks and a number of different boat slips and other elements. So you're going to be applying the guidelines to the elements provided in this on this site. So you would consider the total number of boat slips on the site to determine the total number of boat slips required to be accessible. And as Paul pointed out, other elements that would need to be follow specific provisions that have already been addressed by the standard might include, you know, retail spaces or an office or some other type of a toilet and bathing facility. Slide 37. So when it comes to boating facilities, we basically had to look at both fixed boating facilities. And in doing so, it was not too difficult to actually apply the provisions that already exist within the standards for accessible routes and other space elements, other clearances required for elements, since it's a fixed object. Slide number 38. On the other hand, within boating facilities, we're often dealing with floating boating facilities. So this was most definitely the most challenging aspect of developing the provisions, because we're now dealing with a pretty unique environment and also very challenging when it came to providing accessibility, particularly where there's water level changes. And since we're dealing with the entire country where there's varying water level changes, we were trying to develop a rule that could easily take into consideration all the different areas of the country and all the different water level changes that one might have to deal with. Slide number 39. So this is an example of a floating facility that was in Alaska, which just has a very significant tidal change, and you can see the challenge there of providing access to that floating facility. So when it came to the actual development of the provision, this is one of the extreme areas where we had to consider a lot of different factors. Slide 40. So obviously what we needed to address was the issue of what would be the maximum gangway slope for that gangway that attached to a floating facility. And we, when it came to this issue, there was lots of input and debate and discussion for many years about what that should look like. And the input came from not just persons with disabilities, but also facility operators, manufacturers. And the whole concept sort of was built around trying to balance the needs of individuals with disabilities with cost and safety and dealing with the extreme situation. So we came out with a requirement that basically says in new construction that you must design the gangway to meet a 1 in 12 maximum slope at all times or provide at least an 80-foot gangway. So obviously if you have an area with a tidal change, water level change of maybe 2 to 3 feet or even 4 feet, you would not have to have an 80-foot gangway. But on the other hand, if you had a 10-foot water level change and you were designing to a 1 in 12, that would require that your gangway be 120 feet. So this is saying that basically we are limiting that length to 80 feet. So it acknowledges that this is a unique environment and that also there is not going to be 100% access at all times during the day for all people with disabilities. And we had a question that basically was kind of focused on that issue about how the board would expect people using manual wheelchairs and other devices to use the 80-foot gangway when it's even at a steeper angle than 1 to 12. And, again, the provisions were the result of, a lot of balancing of issues, safety, cost, and accessibility, and, dealing with the unique environment. So, we had to, that was the solution that we came up with. So let's move on to slide number 41. I want to point out here that when it comes to the gangways that need to comply, it is only the gangways that connect to accessible boating slips. And so we're going to talk about the idea of clustering accessible boat slips in a moment, but basically you see an illustration here where you have a gangway that's leading to a facility. On the other hand, you have another entry point that is not the accessible gangway. So you have the option within a facility to cluster, which would in many cases reduce the number of gangways that may have to comply with this provision. Slide 42. We have included an exception for what we call smaller facilities. Those were facilities with less than 25 boat slips. What we're saying here is that the slope of the gangway has to be a 1 in 12 maximum slope, and the gangway has to be at least 30 feet long. So in this case, we're not requiring that you go to the 80 foot, taking in consideration that it is a smaller facility. In some cases, small facilities, if we maintain the 80 foot gangway, it may be a longer gangway than the size of the facility itself. Additionally, whenever the board does do rulemaking, we have to always consider the cost impact on small facilities and small businesses. So this was an exception that was added to address concerns from those entities. Slide 43. So unlike other sloped routes, we do not have a requirement for an intermediate landing. In other accessible routes for ramps, we require that you have a landing every 30 feet if it's a 1 in 12 at a 1 in 12 slope. Due to the nature of this environment and the design of gangways, we had to modify this, and basically there is no requirement related to landings based on the rise. So in this case, what you're looking at is a landing at the top and the bottom of the gangway. Slide 44. So where you might have a gangway that is serving accessible slips, you may have the situation that is illustrated here where you might have a gate for security purposes that is on the entrance part of the gangway. In this case, we're pointing out here that that gangway, that gate that's provided to enter the gangway would have to comply with the maneuvering clearances for doors and gates, which would provide sufficient space, as you see on the right here, for an individual using a mobility device to get beyond the swing of the door to open that gate, door or gate. Slide 45. Here we're looking at transition plates, and basically that would be provided at the end of the gangway, and the requirement here with respect to landings has to do with the slope of the transition plate. If the slope of the transition plate itself is less than 5%, then you're not required to have a landing at the end of the transition plate. If, however, it exceeds 5%, you would be required to have a landing at the end of that transition space. And so the landing would have to be as wide as the gangway and at least 60 inches in length. Slide 46. We require handrail extensions where you have gangways. And I wanted to point out in this that we have the requirement would apply to gangways, but it would also apply to the transition plate if the slope of that transition plate, again, is greater than 5% and more than a 6-inch rise. So at that point, it would be considered a ramp and then trigger the handrail requirement. So where you have handrails on both, the handrail extensions are not required. Slide 47. So here it's a look at the minimum width of the gangway. That is the gangway that's serving, again, the accessible route. We have a 36-inch minimum width. We recognize in many facilities, and probably most facilities, you're going to have a wider gangway to accommodate the use of this, the many uses of the gangway with not just people, but equipment that moves up and down. So we had a question that came in also on this issue related to the width of a route, and also I guess the requirement in some cases, this person was pointing out that I guess their understanding was that it had to be 8 foot wide, the gangway, and of course, as I just mentioned, that's not our minimum width requirement, but their concern was when you do have requirements for 8 or 6 foot, is there some balancing that needs to go on with respect to the regulations for fish or habitat that may require a narrower structure. And you know, again, we don't see this as a conflict here since our minimum width is 36, and we would assume that anything that's wider than this would be addressing the concerns that there might be about fish or other habitat and any requirements that would come from those regulations. Slide 48. So we require that on the gangways, on the transition plates, and on the floating piers that would serve the accessible slips, that there be a maximum 1 in 50 or 2% cross slope. That cross slope measurement applies sort of in the static position. So in other words, that you would design these elements to meet that. We recognize that since it's a floating environment, they will move, but we're wanting to ensure that they are designed with that 1 in 50 maximum standard. 49. So in some cases, you may have this situation where you have a fixed ramp on a floating facility, as you see illustrated in the photo here. And in this case, we just want to point out that the fixed ramp needs to comply with the provisions for an accessible route, so not the gangway slope provisions, but the 1 in 12 maximum slope and the rise requirement every 30 feet. You'd have to have a landing, and edge protection, handrails, et cetera. So that would be a fixed ramp on a floating facility. Slide 50. So in that same case, you may have a fixed facility and have that accessible route that would lead to your accessible boat slips. So as I mentioned before, the accessible route provisions would apply in this case to that fixed route. So you would be applying all the same provisions I just mentioned with respect to landings where you have any kind of slope or a slope that's greater than 5%, edge protection, handrails, et cetera. Slide 51. There is a provision in the boating facility guidelines that allows for the use of a elevator or platform lift. There have been, we're aware of at least one device that was designed for the marine environment. So this could be used in lieu of the accessible route, complying with the accessible route or accessible gangway provisions. It's just an option within the provisions. Slide 52. So when it comes to determining the number of boat slips required to be accessible, you basically look at the number of boat slips that have been provided. You can see in the illustration here, we have a number of docks and a number of slips. So in applying the scoping provisions, what you would do is look at the total number of slips in this facility to determine the number of accessible boat slips. Again, it's always based on the number that you provide, total number you provide. Slide 53. So here are the requirements based on a chart you see on the right-hand side here. So if you had 125 boat slips, this would require in new construction that 4 of the boat slips be accessible boat slips. When we developed this, we used sort of a modified accessible vehicle parking table, which is also based on the total number of parking spaces provided. It's pretty consistent with the vehicle parking provisions up to 100, and then it's drastically different, much less than what we would require for accessible vehicle or van spaces. So this chart is located in the the scoping provisions for and 235 of the boating provisions. Slide 54. Where you have a pier, as you see illustrated here in this slide, that is one straight linear space, we want you to use 40 linear feet of pier edge to determine how many boat slips you have. So if they're not marked as indicated on the previous slide as boat slips, we want you to calculate every 40 linear feet of pier edge as the number in determining the number of boat slips that would be required. In this facility here, I think it does go beyond 40 linear feet, but this would require here that you have one boat slip, therefore that one slip would have to be accessible. Slide 55. So what we're looking at in terms of the accessible boat slip is basically clear space adjacent to where the vessel is moored, so that an individual using a mobility wheelchair or a mobility device would have sufficient space to be able to transfer and maneuver to gain access to their vessel. So we're looking at a 60-inch width clear pier space. We are permitting obstructions, which would be obviously a part of many of the fixed and floating facilities where you might have pilings or other barriers. So basically, you can have obstructions, but you have to have at least one opening of 60 inches in width every 10 feet. So this would provide some different options in terms of space, spaces that would be available for transfer onto a vessel. Obviously, the vessels are going to vary, as will the size. We also permit edge protection. It's not required, but we do permit it, and we'll give a little bit more detail of that in a moment. Slide 56. So these provisions in it themselves do not require that you provide a method for individuals to transfer onto their vessels. So that's not required by the standards. Again, what we're doing in this in these provisions is to look at ensuring that there's sufficient space for someone to be able to use whatever device they're going to use to try to transfer onto their vessel. As you can see here, there's a number of ways that people do that, some using some sort of a bosun's chair, other people using a transfer box, and a variety of other ways or other methods are used. So again, the requirement is that you have sufficient space so that these different methods could be used. Slide 57. So here's another look at the clear, the accessible boat slips and that clear space reduction. Basically, this is saying that you can, within the 60 inches, we're permitting you to reduce that width to a minimum of 36 inches, but you can only do that for a distance of 24 inches. So as illustrated here, this is, again, trying to consider the different elements that might be located within the boat next to, adjacent to where the vessel is, to make it also usable by someone with a mobility device. Slide 58. So here is also showing you those areas permitted to be obstructed with your openings, your 60-inch minimum openings. Moving on to 59. Now, I mentioned this briefly a little earlier that basically your accessible boat slips are required to be dispersed among the different types of slips that are provided. So in a facility, as you see located or noted here, you may have shallow water slips or seasonal slips or deep water slips, transient slips, ones that have cable connections, ones that don't. Those are examples of the different types of slips that you may have. You may have many more different types than these. What this is saying, however, is that you're not required to increase the number of slips required to be accessible to meet the different types that you have. So let's say that you only have as a minimum three accessible boat slips required, but you have maybe five or six different types. This is saying basically that you only have to disperse the three to three different types. In that case, we would recommend that you disperse them to the types of slips that are the most popular within your facility. So again, it doesn't require to increase the number of boat slips that you are providing, accessible boat slips that you are providing. Slide number 60. This is the provision related to clustering. This permits you to cluster your accessible boat slips if you can meet that clustering within the different types. So if you have the three different type requirements, or three different types and three different accessible boat slips required, and you can meet that within one within one pier, you're permitted to do that. So the implication there would be that you would have the limit of applying the gangway guidelines only to that particular gangway. If you are able to meet your dispersion requirement and locate your accessible slips on the one pier. If you're not able to do this, then of course the gangway requirement would apply to any of the boat slips that are located in other areas of the facility. So you may have one that is located on the exact opposite end of the another pier just because that's where one of the other types has to be located because perhaps it's the only place where there's deep water. Slide 61. So there is no requirement, unlike parking spaces, accessible parking spaces, there is no requirement for identification because these boat slips are not reserved in the same way that accessible vehicle parking spaces are reserved. What we would encourage you to do is to make this information available about your accessible boat slips and any kind of promotional material or a facility guide that you might provide. It's, in the past, it hasn't. There often is not a lot of accessibility features provided in boating facilities, and so it hasn't tended to be a very welcoming environment for individuals who are looking for accessibility. So to the extent that you can make that information aware to individuals who might be looking for access, that your facility is one that does provide this accessibility, that would be important. We recognize that there are some issues related to the operational aspects of perhaps the accessible boat slips and how they are reserved. We generally guide you, and this is really not our area, but through the rulemaking process and some conversations with the Department of Justice, we have kind of come to a discussion about how they are similar to accessible hotel rooms in terms of the reservation procedures and policies. And we would encourage you to look to the guidance that has already been provided with respect to transient lodging in this particular area. But if you have other questions about that reservation policy and how long you would need to keep a transient accessible boat slip available for use, I would encourage you to contact the Department of Justice. And we have included their number at the end of this presentation. Slide 62. Here's some more detail on the edge protection. Again, if the edge protection is an option, some people will do prefer this to be provided so that they can have something to put their wheels up against while making some maneuver or transferring on the slip or into their vessel. So if you provide it, again, you have to have at an opening. It can only be 4 inches high maximum and 2 inches deep. So that's a little more detail on the edge protection option if you do provide it. Slide 63. So here we're looking at the elements that might be provided along a slip, and in this case that are connected or serving the accessible boat slip. You might have hose bibs, water supply hoses, outlets for electric and cable. For those elements that serve accessible boat slips, you have to comply with the provisions related to reach ranges. And you see on the right-hand side here, that was something that got modified from the 91 standards to the 2010. The reach range maximum is now 48 inches with a low of 15 inches. So that would apply to any of the operating control mechanisms that you'd find on any of these water supply hoses or outlets, electric or cable. Again, the units that are serving the accessible slips, that's the ones that this would apply to. Slide 64. Securement cleats and other securement devices are not required to be in reach ranges. So those have an exception and do not, again, have to meet the reach ranges, which would obviously not be practical. Slide 65. So when it comes to boarding piers, we are only addressing in these provisions boarding piers at launch ramps. So what we have said about these are where you have floating boarding piers at launch ramps and you have gangways, you use the same provisions that you would use for a smaller facility. You would have to design it for a 1 in 12 or provide up to at least a 30-foot gangway. If your accessible route ends up being within the boat launch ramp, then we have exempted the slope requirements. We don't want to have a conflict with the design of launch ramps and the slopes needed to be able to launch your boat. So we've exempted the slope requirements. Again, this is only where the accessible route might have to go within the boat launch ramp itself. Slide 66. So the boat boarding pier itself, we've required the entire length of the boarding pier to be 60 inches wide, and every 10 foot maximum of pier edge has to have that clear opening of 60 inches in length. Slide 67. So now we're going to move into alterations. Launch ramps at, again, I mentioned that we have provisions for launch ramps at with boarding piers. Here we're showing you a launch ramp without a boarding pier. We don't have specific requirements for those launch ramps. Again, the trigger is where you have a boarding pier connecting with a launch ramp. So, slide 68, we're going to talk about alterations to existing facilities. Slide 69, the first question is, what's considered an alteration? And we have some examples here of redesigning boat slips and replacing floating docks or resurfacing a parking lot. Those are all things that would be considered an alteration. And what's important to note about that is when you do an action that is considered an alteration, you trigger the alterations provisions. On the other hand, if you're doing a maintenance activity, you don't trigger the alterations provisions. So painting, re-roofing, and other general maintenance activities are not considered alterations. So slide 70. So the basic requirements for alterations is that you follow the provisions as noted, the ones we've been discussing so far related to, you know, the boating facility guidelines or the other facility elements that Paul mentioned. So within alterations, however, there's a couple different provisions. One is the notion that if you're doing an alteration to an existing element, you may have what we say is something that is technically infeasible to accomplish. So there are no specific examples related to boating facilities. However, in a building, they would use the example of a load-bearing wall that can't be modified. So in that case, they would consider that to be technically infeasible, and therefore your obligation is to do the best you can to design it to the maximum extent feasible. The other thing about alterations is the basic concept is that whatever you're altering, whatever you touch, you fix. So if you are doing an alteration to the toilet or bathing facility, then you would make that accessible based on the technical provisions. Now, where you do, as Paul mentioned, an alteration to some primary function area, which would be the boat slip area, it does carry an additional obligation. And that's moving on to 71. So the obligation here, as Paul mentioned before, is that you have to make the area that you're altering accessible, and then you also have to spend an additional 20% of the total cost of that alteration to your boat slip area towards an accessible path of travel to the altered area. So as illustrated here, you may be doing work on the boat slips. You have a gangway that is indicated in the noted by the arrow, and in this case, triggering that 20%. Let's say that is a gangway that doesn't comply. Your path travel obligation, which is up to 20%, may go towards making that gangway more accessible. Now you're only obligated to go up to 20%, and in this case, that may not be what is necessary for you to make that fully compliant. There is some guidance by the Department of Justice about the priorities for or the order of elements to be considered as part of the path of travel. You know, really looking outside of the facility, how someone would get to the altered area, the slip area that you've now made accessible. So it could be the parking area, it could be any kind of entrance you have to the facility, and any elements along the way that could include toilet and bathing or drinking fountains, etc. Slide 72. So we do have a provision within the the provisions that is a special technical provision, and actually someone asked this question prior to the webinar, that if you're replacing a gangway in the same dimensions, does it have to adhere to the ADA rule, or is it considered maintenance? Well, it would definitely not be considered maintenance, but basically we do have an exception that, as noted here, that where an existing gangway is replaced or altered, you're not required to put it to increase its length unless it's triggered by that path of travel requirement. So that's a kind of a special technical alteration provision that's been included within the document. Slide 73. There's also a special alteration provision related to accessible boat slips, where you're altering accessible boat slips. This is permitting you to locate the accessible 60-inch minimum width, as indicated here in this illustration, where it might be where the stern of the vessel would be located as opposed to alongside the vessel. Slide 74. We do have an accessibility or a technical assistance summary, we call it, on boating facilities that is available on our website at the link that you see noted here. We, I think, at this point are out of print copies. We will be printing additional copies hopefully soon. But for now, you can download it from our website using that web address. And at this point, we want to open it up to questions. It looks like some people have already submitted some questions here, so I'm going to start off. Oh, I'm sorry, I want to go back. There were a few questions that came in before that didn't neatly fit in anywhere, so I just want to first respond to those. Somebody asked a question about the exception that we have related to railings that is included in our fishing and pier and platform guidelines. And so basically the answer to the question is that that exception does not apply to boating facilities. It is for fishing piers and platforms. And so we at this point have not yet done a webinar on fishing piers and platforms. It probably will happen in the future, and we would talk about that in more detail during that time, or you can feel free to call the Access Board hotline, as Paul mentioned. Another question had to do with, let's see here, you know, what steps are going to be taken to teach cities and private marinas regarding their obligations? Is there a phase-in time for compliance? Well, I think Paul addressed how you you deal with existing facilities under Title II and under Title III. You know, basically cities and private marinas are responsible for learning about their obligations under the ADA, like any other federal regulation, any kind of environmental regulation, you have the same obligation. We do provide technical assistance on our hotline and training, and we've had a fair amount of targeted training programs in this area of boating and marina facilities, accessibility. So our work is obviously not done, and if you have any request for training or have a training opportunity, we'd be happy to talk to you about that. So please let us know. Okay. We also had several questions related to reservoirs and other bodies of water where there's been a significant drought and the water level has been changing or moving to a point where the facility is basically chasing the water, as someone described it. And, you know, we understand that's it's an extreme situation that is occurring in several areas right now. Our guidelines don't specifically address that condition, that situation. We think, you know, obviously if you were, when you built this facility new, it would be hard for you to determine that this type of water condition might be occurring. So it's not something that it would be easy for you to anticipate. And I also understand that you're now dealing with the water bed. You're below the water line. So our recommendation is that you look to operational issues, just like you're doing for the entire facility at this point. You're looking to move the elements away, maybe from parking and other structures and services. You're either going to move those closer to the facility, or you're going to figure out how to get people closer to where you've moved the facility. So when you're doing that for all of your patrons of your marina, you need to include people with disabilities, and you need to figure out a plan for how you're going to make that operation accessible to them. And let's see, finally, one other question that came in. Well, actually, I think that was about the same. So let's move on to any questions that came in before. Paul, I know you've been looking at some of these while I've been presenting. So, I'm going to turn this over to Paul, and if he may have some questions in here that he can address while I have a chance to look at these.
Okay, these are some we had gotten prior to the session start. If a storm hits and destroys a portion of the dock, basically, what's subject to ADA? Look, if you rebuild it, that's an alteration. So, as Peggy said, what you touch, you fix. So the bigger the alteration, the more you're expected to bring in compliance. A good example might be where Architectural Barriers Act comes into play is a hurricane significantly damages a marina. Architectural Barriers Act would come into play if FEMA money is being used, probably in most cases, which, depending on the degree of alteration necessary, accessibility would be needed in conformance with the standard. If you have a number of facilities, and this may be more of a program access issue, that are non-conforming, maybe it's gravel parking lots with some sort of incomplete trail leading to maybe not even a floats, but just be a boat launch area. Remember, under program access, state and local governments have to ensure that persons with disability are not denied access to their programs and services. So at the bare minimum, if you have a variety of different sites that offer essentially the same program, some of those sites need to have a higher level of access at them. So a gravel parking lot in most cases for the accessible space would not be considered programmatically accessible. A path leading to the launch point, depending on the condition of the path in terms of its accessibility, would not be considered accessible. Now, further guidance on how program access applies to a variety of primitive type of launch facilities, these are questions you best pose to the Department of Justice, and they would probably evaluate on a case-by-case basis. Another question would seem to be more if you got something that's existing, maybe it's a launch ramp and there's a skid pier and you have your accessible route to it, but there's a cross-slope problem, do I need to modify it? Well, come March 15, 2010, there's no doubt this was a public accommodation that would be a non-conforming feature and would have to be corrected or readily achievable. And readily achievable is defined in the Title III regs. question came up about questioning whether GSA adopted their Architecture Bearer Standard in 2006 or in 2005. Under the Architecture Bearers Act, there are four standard-setting agencies. The Postal Service adopted our Barriers Act guidelines and made it into their Barriers Act standard in 2005. So they were the first standard-setting agency under the Architecture Bearers Act to take that action. GSA did it in 2006, and then they added leasing provisions in 2007. Now, the leasing provisions under the Architecture Bearers Act only apply to the federal government. There's been some questions about confusion over the use of the word safe harbor. What does it mean? What does slide 20 tell us? Safe harbor is a term used by the Department of Justice in their regs. And what they're trying to say is, if things that are built under the 91 standard and conform to the 91 standard, you're not required to change them if under program access or under barrier removal until you alter the feature in question. So they're trying to give that as a safe harbor. And slide 20 lists the things that would not be eligible for the safe harbor, and all the things listed on slide 20 are provisions that are only in the 2010 standard and are not in the 1991 standard. So therefore, when you alter a BODI facility under the 2010 standard, you know, what you touch, you fix. There's no safe harbor for the building components. A question was asked about maximum length of an accessible route from like the site arrival to point to the accessible boot slip. The standard doesn't address that. That's not addressed in the standard. The standard requires at least one accessible route be provided and coincide with the route used by others in a general circulation path. So there's no distance requirement. Yes, for gates at gangways, do you need a clearance on both sides of this level? Yes. A door that's going to the accessible gangway is part of the accessible route, and there has to be a certain amount of level maneuvering clearance on both sides of the side of the door, depending on whether it's the push side of the door or the pull side. We define in the 2010 standard level as no steeper than 1 in 48 in any direction, which is about 2% slope. Gangway edge protection was raised. The way the gangway provisions are written, they modify the accessible route requirements in Chapter 4, particularly the ramp requirements in Section 405. So you basically apply the ramp requirements to your gangway unless a particular provision has been modified. So, for example, the ramp slope requirement, as Peggy pointed out, was modified. It didn't have to be 1 in 12 if your gangway was 80 feet long or longer, or for smaller facilities was 30 feet long or longer. The edge provisions for ramps have not been modified. So you would apply the edge protection provisions to the gangways per the ramp provisions in Section 405. We have no guardrail requirements in the standard. We have handrail requirements, as Peggy pointed out, but we have no guardrail requirements. Those issues are not addressed in the standards for the ADA or Architecture Bearers Act. That would probably be something under your local safety code. Hopefully, since we only have a few minutes left, whether I can give it back to Peggy and she's prepared to discuss some things that are in the questions. While she's shifting over, again, if you have questions and we're not able to answer it, please call us on our technical assistance line and we're more than willing to help you discuss it. Some of these are very complicated and we have to sort of describe the big picture and then boil down. Can you provide a name of a manufacturer who makes lists for marine environment? No, we specifically can't. Peggy pointed out the platform lift provisions that we allow. One of the purposes of us putting that in the rule was to encourage manufacturers to develop products that are like a platform lift, that might be cheaper than an elevator that can provide that connection instead of using a gangway. There are manually powered lifts, which the standard doesn't allow, but as part of a access solution, not conforming to the standard, but maybe if you can't meet the requirements because it was technically infeasible and the maximum extent feasible is a manually powered platform lift, there are devices that were going to allow usage for purposes of connecting to a passenger vessel that are similar to like the Amtrak platform lift. And you can find those on the internet. I think Adaptive Engineering is one such company that makes them. But again, unless used in the in alterations where it's technically infeasible, you could not use a manually powered lift to meet your connection, your vertical connection requirements.
Okay. So I've had a chance to look at some of the questions here, and Paul has responded to many of them. There was a question here about the 36-inch clear opening as it relates to gangways, and I don't know if the question is, you know, where did we come up with that? Because then there's another related question that has to do with the 60 inches on boarding piers. And let me try to tie the two together. I mean, basically, the 36-inch minimum width for that gangway and that route are what is the minimum for an accessible route within the standard, and that's been consistent, you know, since the early 90s. We simply applied that to this boating environment here. Now, on a boarding pier, since they don't tend to be as long, again, this is where it's associated with the launch ramp, they're basically long enough to be able to get your vessel alongside to be able to get into the vessel. We said that had to be, the entire boarding pier had to be 60 inches, so that was why there was the difference. We also recognized that in most cases, the gangway and the pier are going to be much wider than 36 inches, so that was just the minimum width that was implied or required. There's also a question here about, you know, kind of what does the DOJ have to do with, you know, an Army Corps of Engineers, what do these standards have to do with Army Corps of Engineers, and that you've used ADAG and UFAS, and I think Paul's mentioned this a couple times. Remember that the Architectural Barriers Act standards were updated. UFAS is no longer the standard. And in 2006, you were required to comply, right, for GSA? You were required to comply with the new standards, which are the same as the DOJ standards that just got adopted. Now, Army Corps of Engineers was a little bit different in that since you weren't under GSA, you were covered under Department of Defense, and they took a little bit longer to adopt the new standards, and actually that was 2008. So since 2008, you have been required for new construction and alteration to follow the Architectural Barriers Act standard, so and no longer UFAS. I think maybe we have time for one or two more. Let me find one here. Actually, there's some here. There's a couple of questions here about, you know, the racks. And we definitely have not included, that's not what we would be considering a boat slip. And so you shouldn't be using the number of dry racks where you store vessels as, you know, part of your in determining the total number of slips. We are talking about wet slips, as someone noted. So then another individual just wanted to confirm if an existing Title II facility must upgrade to conform to the 2010 by March 15, 2012, if no other alteration are planned. And I think we addressed this a little bit earlier, but What happens on March 15, 2012 is that the requirement for program accessibility and readily achievable barrier removal, program accessibility for Title II entities, it still applies. Nothing has changed. The difference is that these boating facility guidelines now are part of what you need to do and look at in terms of facilities and elements in achieving your program accessibilities. So all the recreation facilities, including boating facilities, are on that list of areas that you need to address to achieve accessible boating facilities. The March 15th deadline does not mean that you have to bring all of your existing facilities up to the 2010 standard. Again, that is when those elements become a part, need to become part of your plan for removing barriers and being addressed by program accessibility. And I believe at this point we are out of time, so I'm going to turn it over to Robin or someone from the Great Lakes ADA Center.
Great, and thank you very much both Paul and Peggy in relationship to this particular session, and you've got the information of how to contact the Access Board, and you've heard both Peggy and Paul say that they are more than willing to respond to your questions. Many of them that were submitted by people were very complicated and would not lend themselves to a quick answer, and that's why you may feel that your question did not get answered today, and we really do strongly encourage you to directly contact them with your specific scenario to address that. And we do want to invite you to attend next week's session, next month's session, which is going to switch gears altogether and get out of the water. And we'll now be into accessible schools, and that's scheduled for December 1st of 2011. I do want to remind people that this session was recorded. The archive will be available on the website, accessibilityonline.org, under the archive session section, as are all of our sessions available there. They're searchable by topic, dates, et cetera, to be able to find one or many that might be of interest if you may have missed them in the past. So we do encourage you to visit that. This archive will be posted along with the handouts from today's session as well, as all of our archives also include the handout materials. So we thank you very much for your participation today. To exit the session, you can either just close your browser or there's a little icon in the lower left-hand corner that looks like two connection cords coming together. If you just click on that, that will also disconnect you. So thank you very much, and thank you again, Peggy and Paul, and have a good day.